The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning. Very welcome along to the show. 5 minutes past nine on this Thursday. It's the 30th of April. How are you all keeping? I hope you're very well. I really do. And it's great to have you listening today. We've got lots coming up on the programme, as you can imagine. The usual mix packed into a very busy 2 hours. And we want your calls and your comments coming into us as well. If there's anything you want to comment on as we move through the programme, or an issue you wish to raise, or indeed pass on some news, maybe an act of kindness, whatever you want to do. I'm just leaving the options open to you. 086 60 25000, that is our WhatsApp and our text number, 086 60 25000, or call 07491 25000, and email comments at highlandradio.com. Watch along if it suits you at home, on your smart TV or your Fire Stick, on the YouTube app, search Highland Radio Ireland. That's good for your mobile devices as well. And we're across our Facebook pages, so there's literally no excuse. So just to remind you as well, if there's something that sparks your interest, maybe you're at work or in the car and you don't hear it all, you go, well, I missed the start of that, or that sounded interesting. Well, you can also podcast the programme. It's available for you from 11:30 on our website. The papers this morning, and it's Thursday, so that means there's quite a few of them. The Tyrconnell Tribune, Deputy Padraig McLaughlin has said the government's social contract with people is dead and buried due to its ongoing failure to confront the housing crisis, including homelessness spiralling to a record high. Meanwhile, data on social housing shows that Donegal was one of 18 local authorities that failed to increase expenditure in this sector last year due to government cuts by the housing minister. McLaughlin said the government, or this government, is actively making the housing crisis worse. On to the Derry People, Donegal News. The chairman of the local community safety partnership has described domestic abuse figures in Donegal as a cancer in our society. Councillor Jerry McMonagle has said he'll make urgent contact with Donegal Domestic Violence Services in the wake of stark figures obtained by the newspaper from Ongara Síochána. The figures reveal 1,400 domestic abuse-related calls were made in Donegal's division in 2025. Now, when we talk about domestic abuse on this show, and we do regularly, it's often almost, you know, people sometimes try and play it down. But 1,400 calls. Now, some of them are going to be repeat calls, I would imagine. I wouldn't imagine it's 14 individual cases, but it's 1,400, sorry, individual calls and instances, right? So that's in no way to dilute the figures. The figures also show there were 152 incidences relating to the breach of barring safety and protection orders in 2025 in the Donegal Division. In the first 3 months of this year, 26 such incidences were recorded in the Donegal Division. So 1,400 calls a year. So that is five a day, almost. That's taking up an awful lot of Garda resources, but it also points to a particular problem that we have. And it seems talking about it is not really impacting the figures. I wonder what else needs to be done. Let me know, 086 60 25000. And really what that means is that, unfortunately, there are probably many of you listening to this programme that have had to make those calls. Statistically, it has to be the case, such as the volume of calls. The Irish Times, these stories are not good for charities, generally speaking, because even though it's a reference to one charity, it kind of then can potentially, though it shouldn't, cast a shadow over the charity sector. We've seen that in the past with controversies on a single charity having an impact on donations elsewhere. But the alleged transfer of more than €1.5 million of taxpayers' money from an Irish autism charity to its UK parent charity could be a breach of the Companies Act and possibly a criminal offence, it is claimed in internal correspondence within the charity. Indeed, it shouldn't be happening, should it? It doesn't sound right. It emerged earlier this week the Health Service executive has commenced a review into the governance and finances of Autism Initiatives Ireland, which has this year rebranded to Autism Acara. The charity, which provides specialist care to autistic adults, did not answer questions from the Irish Times about the allegations of possible criminality, but said the HSE had previously examined these allegations and claimed there was no impropriety to find. I don't want to be too parochial about something as serious as this, but the government, presumably the HSC, gave this charity £1.5 million, presuming it would be administered in Ireland. Maybe it's being administered in Ireland from Britain, I don't know. But anyway, it doesn't seem right to move funding of that level outside of the state. I'm not sure if that's something that you agree with or disagree with. One in seven households, this is the Independent today, one in seven households cannot afford to warm their homes or pay energy bills. An ESRI study has found households experienced energy poverty when they're unable to afford essential services such as heating, lighting, cooking, or using appliances. Now, this is the critical part of this, and I think the problem has gotten much worse since. The ESRI report said 14% of households were unable to adequately heat their homes or pay their utility bills in full in 2024. So this is old data, newly released, but it's old data for 2024. Since then, we've seen fuels right across the board skyrocket. So I would imagine that one in seven households unable to heat their homes is much greater. And of course, that's national. So where you've got areas of higher deprivation, lower disposable income, it's going to be worse because it's an average. So you're including a rich part of Dublin, for an example, with a poorer part of Donegal. So that's a national overview. So I'd imagine the figure's much, much higher. Could it be as high as one in three in Donegal, or one in four, perhaps, potentially? Certainly considering those figures relate to 24 and don't really capture the crisis since the Iranian situation. The 1926 census has been digitalised and put online. Lots of people having a look at it. Did you have a look at it? Did you find anything interesting? I read somewhere that the website can be quite clunky, and there's one of the Ancestry websites which you can sign up to for free. I'm not sure which, but it has a better search mechanism if you want to find stuff out. That the one where the information is posted first is a little bit clunky. But anyway, Ireland's transition from a rural society in which half the country worked the land to the economy of today, where just 1 in 25 people earn their living from the soil, is revealed in an in-depth analysis of the Free State's first ever census. The 1926 records provide a comprehensive insight into life in the early days of the Irish Free State. The look back through time was revealed yesterday by the CSO, which has produced Then and Now, Life in Ireland in 1926 and 2026. Can you dig that out? Maybe Caroline, can Shannon dig out that CSO release from yesterday comparing 1926 to now? Some highlights are picked out in the paper. I wouldn't mind having a look through it myself. But how times have changed. In 1926, 26% of the workforce were women. I'm not sure if you think that's high or low. Now, 47% of the workforce, or in 2022 at the last census, 47% of the workforce were women. So that's a huge increase. 51% of the population in 1926 were employed in farming. That's down to 4% now. So we talk an awful lot about agriculture and really quite importantly in that it's on its knees and all that kind of stuff. Well, 51% of people were employed in farming 100 years ago, 4% in 2022. Interestingly, is it? 382 people were accountants in 1926. That figure now is 43,000, which is remarkable. And here's an interesting stat. 5,753 fishing industry workers in 1926. Now it's 2,569. So in terms of these figures, the raw figures and workers, those figures are quite low. But the change in fishing is like about 50%. And in farming, it's massive. It's like 92%. Okay. Staying with farming, I suppose, to the Irish Farmers Journal, 60,000 in cap payment battle. Ongoing cap reform talks have reignited the debate around what exactly constitutes an active farmer and which active farmer should be eligible for cap income support payments in the years ahead. Let's go to the red top tabloids now. And interesting, in relation to Michael D. Higgins, former president, well, he returned over 2.6 million back to the state during his 14-year term. Over both his presidential terms, Mr. Higgins returned 622,000 plus change of his 1938 allowance to the Exchequer. This is a €317,000 annual allowance on top of the president's salary. Aras Nuchtaran said Mr. Higgins used the allowance to provide hospitality for the over 20,000 people who visited each year. We visited there 1 year too for the an Irish music event. It was lovely. It was lovely. Never got to see him, but anyway, I heard him, but never got to see him. And cocaine use, and this we see this picked up in figures left, right, and centre, and even in terms of driving under the influence figures. There's no surprise cocaine use is increasing, but apparently it's skyrocketing. New stats have shown another sharp jump in the last 12 months. Cool Mind Therapeutic Community, the National Drug and Alcohol Treatment Centre, has published its figures for the first 3 months of 2026. Alcohol is still Ireland's biggest problem drug in 40% of cases, but cocaine is now growing fast at 35%. In the southwest Cork and Kerry area, the Cool Mind Centre is reporting a sharp increase in the number of families seeking help for loved ones with cocaine issues, and deeply worrying increases in the number of women, both young and older, regularly using the drug. So while booze is certainly still the number one drug, cocaine is coming up the rails very quickly. Regional demand remains highest in the east, where 794 individuals were supported, 409 in the southwest, and 125 in the midwest. In the southwest, 409 clients access services during 2026 first quarter. No reference to the northwest. I wonder if the midwest include the northwest, or they just don't provide services up here. Right, okay, that was a run through some of the newspaper. So Quilla says, Greg, have you heard anything about the state of parking at Letterkenny University Hospital recently? I had an appointment last week and spent 30 minutes stressed driving around trying to find a parking spot for my hospital appointment, and ended up being very late. The car park above St. Connell's was so overcrowded you could barely get through it. How are people meant to be able to attend appointments if they can't get parked? It's a good question, of course. I don't know the answer to that. This is the whole place, car park, hospital. It's just not big enough for a county of our size, it has to be said. I think most people do agree with that. Now, Educate Together, the organisation, has called on the government to provide more non-religious schools in Donegal. Currently, Letterkenny Educate Together National School is the only multi-denominational school in the county. We were due to speak to someone from Educate Together this morning to tease that out a little bit more with them, but they're no longer available. I do have with me, though, and I'm very pleased to welcome him onto the programme, Alan Hines, who's Chief Executive of the Catholic Education Partnership. Alan, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you and good morning.
Where do you think we are at in terms of, you know, the setup of our school system and where you feel it needs to go?
Well, I mean, for well over a decade now, the Catholic patrons, the bishops, have signalled their support for a greater diversity of schools within the system. Certainly under the constitutional framework that Ireland has around education, there is a right for parents to have a very strong influence on the education of their children, and certainly there should be a greater plurality of schools. I would say I think it's primarily the state's responsibility to provide for that choice of school type, but given the historic circumstances and just the position obviously of the church within education right now, the bishops have long recognised, the church has recognised that we have a role to play in assisting the state in that. But just to be clear, it's primarily the state's responsibility. So to that end, we've collaborated with the state on a number of different initiatives to try to secure divestment of some of our schools to alternative patronage, including, let's say, Educate Together, ETB, or Run For Us. It's proven to be a very difficult process. And even now we've seen the latest surveys, and I suppose it's the latest initiative from the department, from the state, which we've also, you know, fully supported along the way. And soon the individual schools will get the results in the next week or two from the department and allow them to have a detailed look at how their parents feel and where they want to go. And our understanding is that the department will identify a certain number of schools who will be invited into a process around divestment to consider it and move it on.
Yeah.
But I think the state is going to have to do a lot more. As someone who's been involved in change process in schools myself in a previous role, and this would have been mainly amalgamations or moving from single sex to co-ed, but also included one divestment of a school. It takes a long time. You've got to go in, you've got to talk to a community, you've got to understand the various different issues going on, you've got to get to know the people. And it's a process that can take a number of years. And you've got to be committed to that, and you just got to be willing to work through it with those communities. And we've been very clear we think the department, the state needs to respect that the communities that these schools are in, and needs to invest in a proper consultation and facilitation process on the ground. That actually takes the long view. This isn't something that's just going to be done through a survey or a flick of a pen or just getting people to vote.
And why does the church seemingly accept that it does need to be done? Because, you know, the figures are, we have some regional breakdowns, but the majority of parents or guardians with children in religious schools are happy for them to be in there. Yeah. And in Donegal, the overwhelming majority, 70-odd%, are happy for them to be in there. And then if you were to break it down to schools within themselves, if 51% would prefer that school to be multi-denominational and 49%, I mean, what is the bar for actually progressing this? Because this survey really, I don't think a lot of people who wanted religion out of schools, you know, on a much greater scale, I don't think they looked at these figures. They might be surprised by them.
I think they possibly were. And you have to remember, those who are probably more invested in change were more likely to vote. You know what I mean? Typically, and again, just from experience of working through change processes, people who are in favour of the status quo are often quite silent in the early stages of these kind of things. So even though you might have that 40% figure nationally or 30% in Donegal, in reality, once you hit the ground, that's likely to be lower. The problem, I suppose, that has presented itself is that you effectively find it very difficult to get the majority in any school who actually want change. The majority are typically happy with the education their children are getting in our schools, which is a great testament to our schools, to our teachers and other staff. And a lot of parents can see the value of Catholic education, even if they themselves aren't Catholic. But we recognise there are minorities, and they are not insubstantial minorities within each school, who would frankly probably prefer a separate thing for their children.
Well, there are, those minorities, I'm not sure if the would tease out, might actually prefer if their children could attend a school of their religion, not multi-denominational.
That's true too. And certainly, again, within the constitutional framework we exist, it's the reason we have two Muslim schools, let's say in Dublin, and a Jewish school, because those communities were large enough and they were able to form schools. And that could pop up in other parts of the country as well. And again, I mean, any rights we claim for ourselves, we obviously have to support for other people too.
Yes, but my point is, like, no one is going to go into those schools and say they need to be multi-denominational.
No, they won't. No. I think, Greg, in fairness, let's say you might look at, take my home parish, there's four schools. In those, you might have 20% in each school who actually want a different change. Mm. So what you'd need to do is negotiate with the community and look at where we'd have three remaining Catholic schools and one alternative choice. However, there is a large practical difficulty. The department, or the state, the Oireachtas, passed a law back in 2018 that basically said Catholic schools and Catholic schools alone are not allowed to prioritise children from that faith. So our friends in the Church of Ireland can prioritise children from a Church of Ireland background. Those Muslim schools and Jewish school I spoke about, they can prioritise children from their religious background. Our schools can't. So when we go into communities and have these conversations, not unreasonably, Catholic families ask us, well, hang on a sec, so is my child guaranteed a place in a Catholic school? And the answer to that right now is no, because of the changes brought in by Minister Richard Bruton at the time when he was Minister for Education. We can't. Now, and they go, in that situation, let's just hold on to all four schools because, well, you know, that's the only way to actually guarantee it.
But the reality is that, you know, Catholic schools will be doing the heavy lifting. So if you want, you know what I mean? It's not necessarily, I don't think, is it, that Catholicism is being singled out. It's just the majority of schools, other than building loads and loads of new schools, that's where that flexibility had to be, I presume.
Yeah, and that's why, I mean, we are, the church, in fairness, has said, yes, this is mainly the state's responsibility. But look, it would just be impractical to turn around to the state. We have, vast majority of primary schools. We've only 46% to post-primary. But at primary level, we've about 87% of the primary schools. So just on a practical basis, the church realised we're rolling this. But we need the state to remove that barrier, the Admissions to Schools Act. It's now an active barrier to divestment, and we need the state to take this community engagement more seriously. And finally, we need to get over this being an ideological battle, where, like, I might be lined up on your show against somebody from a secular point of view, and we kind of battle it out. to be frank, that isn't it's not going to be a constructive way of moving forward. We need to get away from some sense of religion versus secular, and we need to move to just a partnership approach where the state and the church can just work together along with some of the other patrons to actually achieve a result ultimately for the common good. Now, but what we need is we need our schools to be able to prioritise those children. Just where they're oversubscribed, they need to be able to prioritise children from Catholic families, and we need to make sure that our schools can remain Catholic. We have no problem with secular schools or non-religious schools down the road, and what they do, to be frank, is entirely their business. But we want to keep our schools authentically Catholic in that sense and offer that Catholic approach to education in a proper way.
And we can look at other, we also do, because we're at a point now where we maybe can do this correctly. We look at other areas. I've got family in different parts, and you can't get into a Catholic school. You get to the point whereby people who want their children to be educated in a Catholic school can't get into a Catholic school because they moved. That it became so divergent and multi-denominational that the Catholic schools became the minority and the hot property, so to speak.
We don't really see it in Ireland, but in other countries,
In
other countries in Europe, Catholic schools are very popular because people recognise there is something of value that we have to offer, and Catholic schools are under huge demand. I mean, I meet my European counterparts from time to time; their schools are under huge pressure in terms of enrolment. Even in a country, let's say, like Norway, that would be, I suppose, considered reasonably liberal or progressive, the number of religious schools there, now the predominant Christian denomination there is Lutheran, are increasing because of parental demand. Now, that increase isn't necessarily religious parents, but it's parents who actually just want their children to be educated in that kind of school. We're presented here as if sometimes our schools are seen as, that parents are just waiting to be liberated from them. That's not the truth, well, and I suppose the survey demonstrates that.
And just in relation to that, and I know you don't want to get into a negative conversation, but I'll ask you a straight up question. How much of this is about parents across Ireland wanting to have this conversation about education and the right type of education for their children? And how much of it is probably still being driven by sort of an anti-Catholic church drive that's out there? And of course, and quite rightly so, the Catholic Church went through some very, very difficult times. Certain governments in power at certain times made decisions that were very clearly sort of anti-Catholics, I think people would agree. But I'm just curious, Alan, as Chief Executive of the Catholic Education Partnership, how much is this conversation now is about ridding Catholicism out of schools, and how much is it about getting the right education for our population?
As ever, I think you need to attend to the people who are maybe being a little bit quieter. The louder voices in this do often present, to be frank, as being maybe hostile to the church, hostile to Catholicism, hostile to Catholics, and seem to be driven by a desire, yes, just simply to get the church out of the education system. But there are a group of parents who just genuinely want a different option for their children. Mm-hmm. Now, they're the people we're attending to. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're the parents we're conscious of trying to work with the state to achieve something for. We're not going to get distracted by those kind of loud voices. But they are there. And this one, I talk about getting away from the ideological battle. I think the state too needs to stop paying attention to those voices and actually just listen to parents and work in partnership with ourselves. But it is the quieter parent voice that we're more attentive to, not these louder voices. And you can see just, I think, some of those secular campaigning groups who are quite hostile to Catholics have given up on the idea of divestment. They've seen that it's very difficult. They've seen that there isn't a huge amount of support for it. I think 10 years ago, there was an expectation that there was just loads of parents waiting to kind of get their children out of Catholic schools. And that simply isn't true. It wasn't true then. It still isn't true now. And so now they're trying to get ORE out of the school day is kind of the latest campaign, because having failed to get community support on the ground for their project, they're now going to try to impose something from above in terms of just, taking religious education out of the school day, which is just trying to work around what parents actually, what communities have expressed they wanted. So ORE is an integral part, religious education is an integral part of Catholic education. it isn't the only part, and we have a very broad view. Our view of education has taken the whole human person, intellectual, moral, physical, spiritual. So we're committed to all that. But for us, religious education is a very important part of that overall holistic approach. They now just, I mean, this is where the campaign has shifted to. If you pay attention to those voices, they've kind of just given up on the divestment thing. And now it's just, they essentially want to secularize our schools. So here you go, you can keep your Catholic schools, but we're just going to remove any ability you have to actually be Catholic. Now, that's obviously not something we're going to yield on. And, I think, again, policymakers need to pay attention more to what community voices are saying. If the majority of parents have voted in favour in individual schools of keeping the school Catholic, that means they want what we have.
Yeah, I often
So.
think too, and I won't delay you any further, but I often think too that people sort of bring in church attendance as part of this conversation, or attitudes towards marriage or communion, or, and I understand that, but I mean, you can be a Catholic and go and be educated as a Catholic and or a Protestant or whatever religion. And that education is not undermined necessarily by not attending mass every week, if that makes sense.
Well,
maybe you disagree, but
no, I mean, obviously we'd love to see more people attending mass every week and engaging with the sacraments, but look, it's a complicated picture now in terms of faith in Ireland. And you can have, for instance, my parish church would have a reasonably healthy attendance on Sundays, but on Easter Sunday it was jam-packed. There was standing, people, loads of people standing in the church. At Christmas it'll be the same. Ash Wednesday, again, bursting to the seams. And that's quite common in churches around the country. So you have people who are engaging with their faith in different ways. I think some of these groups who point to these things are applying a purity test that the church itself does not apply to its members. Do you know what I mean? It's like they're, unless you meet these standards, you can't be Catholic.
well, I
The
suppose you
church
could
obviously
say
would encourage people to one way, but that isn't the kind
there's
of
lots of
purity
people,
test we
there's
apply.
lots of people listen on the radio, there's lots of people since COVID watch online, and of course the times you mentioned, there's lots of people at home from abroad and want to go back to, there's lots of different scenarios. Anyway, okay, it's an interesting conversation and I appreciate your time this morning, Alan.
And thank you very much for having me on.
Salam.
Appreciate it.
That
Thank you.
is Alan Hines there, who is Chief Executive of the Catholic Education Partnership. And I'd be having this exact same conversation, or maybe putting the same points to Alan, if statistics were in a different direction. It's not my view here, but I'm looking at a survey. I'm looking at a survey that a lot of people took part in, and perhaps those most wanting change perhaps were more inclined to take part, and yet still the majority of parents with children in Catholic schools want them to remain so. So if it was on the flip side, trust me, I'd be putting different points to Alan. I'm not overly religious myself, and I'm not taking a particular side or whatever. I'm just trying to follow the statistics of what the people want and get to the bottom of, it's a little, it reminds me a little, it doesn't remind me a little bit. It's like for me a little bit like the conversation of assisted dying, where it keeps coming back on the agenda and people keep talking about it. And yet I've yet to encounter anyone in real life who has brought this up to me or said they're in favour of it or even said they're against it. But it's a conversation that keeps being brought to the fore to get something over the line and an overhaul of the education system and getting Catholicism or any other religion out of a school. The majority of parents are pretty happy where we're at. That doesn't mean the 40% or the 30% in Donegal, you don't do something to try and accommodate everyone. But you also have to say that was a survey commissioned by the government and they probably weren't expecting the results, not the government, sorry, people who are opposed to the way it is now, probably weren't expecting those results. Now, the next topic, very important to us as a region and very important to a group of individuals. And it's a part of the day where I have to park my own cynicism and my own consciousness of my own mortality and the possibility of me ever engaging with this project. But it really is quite important. And someone who's very passionate about rail is Richard Logue, Project Manager in Transport in London and part of the Western Track Group. Good morning to you, Richard. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, Greg, and I share your hopefulness as well at the same time.
But you still persist, you see, and that's what I admire about you. But that being said, you know, big oak trees grow from little acorns. We're not there at the acorn yet, but there was an important meeting. To actually secure the meeting that we're going to talk about, I think, is actually significant in and of itself. So this was the Donegal Rail Group and Western Track meeting with the Department of Infrastructure Minister Liz Cummings. So tell us about Cummings, yeah. I beg your pardon. Tell us about this meeting then.
Yeah, thanks very much, Craig. And so background to all of this is that we had a joint meeting with Sean Canney, the Rail Minister here in the Republic, before Christmas. And basically the background is that the strategy for the All-Ireland Strategic Rail Review is that Letterkenny will be reconnected to the National Rail Network. But as it stands at the moment, their timeline is looking at it in the late 2030s, early 40s. And given that I'm probably some years older than you, Greg, I would be even less likely to see it at that stage. So what we did is we went back to Sean Canney before Christmas and said, listen, we think you could build this relatively quickly and build it before you actually start thinking about building the old Derry Road from Portadown back up through County Tyrone to Derry. Mm. And it would mean, given the acute traffic situation in Letterkenny and given the fact that we have the Northwest City region being formed as a joint initiative between Derry and Strabane Council and County Donegal, it makes an awful lot of sense. And for a relatively small outlay, you consider the billions they want to spend on Metrolink in Dublin, and for a lot less.
The thing that is kind of a little bit frustrating as well is because it really aligns perfectly at this time in terms of getting cars off the road, right? So there's that side of things. The government's commitment, what is it, 3-to-1 investment in public transport versus roads or whatever it might be. Yep. So and also, too, the fact that it could be done, as you say, relatively cheap. So the only thing that's really missing is the will, Richard, and that's what's really quite frustrating about this, because we could get a minister in and it could be their thing. You know what? We are going to do this, and it would move really quickly.
Absolutely. And, you know, the precedence is there in the past. Back in the early 80s, Albert Reynolds, when he was Minister for Transport, he got the Maynooth line going in the teeth of opposition from both the department and CIE at the time. And you know what? They're electrifying it now. So, you know, there is an element of build it and they will come, but there's also an element of actually trying to kick against the inertia where we think, well, Asher, roads will do. And I'll be honest with you, that's my approach, not just with this, but with a lot of other things. But anyway, getting back to Liz Cummins. So we had a very positive meeting before Christmas with Sean Canney. He said, we've got the money at our end. We're willing to pay for the fee. Because basically our core ask right now is a feasibility study and a route study to look into how viable and practical would it be. Because that's the normal approach you take. It's what I do in projects here in London. You basically work out what the logistics and the costs are and then make a decision. So we're not expecting either government to pony out several billion on a new rail line. We want them to say, right, let's cost it up. Where is it best route for it to go and take it from there? So Sean Canney's on side. Our next hurdle, if you like, was to talk to on the northern side. And Liz Cummins, we did get her meeting with her on Tuesday in Stormont. And I would say, in terms of the optics and in terms of the tone of the meeting, very positive. And it wasn't just Minister Cummins, it was also her senior civil servants and her advisors. So they weren't fielding the B team, they were fielding the A team. And of course, my longstanding colleagues in the West Ulster Rail Initiative, like Canon David Crooks, Mary Casey, Charles Duncan Barclay, and Sean McBride, you know, we were all there fighting with my colleague Peter Bowen Walsh from Western Track. So the minister is very positive. She said, look, you know, you're making a very good case here. We do need to go away and consider it. You're asking us to take the where we are in the strategy and maybe stick, you know, retime it. And obviously I would have to talk to my officials and officials in the Republic on that. The big hurdle, though, is that you're probably all aware that the Northern Ireland Executive itself has not set a budget for the last 2 to 3 years. Therefore, she has no money to spend on this. And that's going to be a political problem. Now, we know down south, the government does have a big pot of money to spend. And the actual ask we're asking them to spend is in the region of about £5 million on a feasibility and route study. I've no doubt the Dublin government could shoulder the cash itself. And what Minister Kimmins did say to us at the meeting was that she is meeting with Sean Kenny next week at the Intergovernmental Conference. And I've already been back in touch with Minister Kenny myself directly to say, look, this is the outcome of our meeting with the minister. And
it'll be very interesting to see if it does come up then for discussion out there, because this project needs to be put on a footing whereby it's not reliant on individual ministers or governments or what have you. It needs to be a presumed green-lit project, so that if the Irish government changes next year, that it's presumed that this is going ahead, rather than you having to form some sort of a relationship with the next minister that's responsible.
Yeah, you're dead right there, Greg. And, you know, it's really important, especially in terms of infrastructure, that we take the party politics out of it and actually say, look, you know, because I can't think anybody would say it's not a good idea to actually build this. It is around doing what's right for the Northwest. We have full backing from Donegal County Council on this. I know the senior officers like Gary Martin and Anne-Marie Conman are very much in line, and I've made sure that what we asked the minister is exactly what the council themselves are asking when they had a meeting with her some months back as well. So I think as campaigners, it's really important that we're taking this seriously, that we're aligned with the key stakeholders. And basically what we are asking the minister is to bring forward the agreed strategy for this region. So we're not asking anything different.
Okay, interesting as always. Thank you so much, Richard. That's Richard Logue, Project Manager in Transport for London and part of the Western Track Group. I know there's a cynicism out there. There's a cynicism in here. But it is edging ever closer. And if it ever does come to fruition, it will be because of the doggedness and determination of people like Richard and others involved in that campaign to get a rail link into this part of the world. Andres Esteves is co-author of Energy Poverty and Affordability in Ireland, and he joins us this morning. Thanks, Andres.
Hi, hello, everyone.
Good to see you. Right, now, over 30% of households in this country face some affordability challenges when it comes to energy costs. This covers 2024. It's the findings of the latest report from the ESRA examining energy poverty issues around the country. So is energy poverty as simple as it sounds? It's whether or not you're actually able to afford to heat your home?
Well, no. Like, energy poverty is a complex issue, and I would, you know, encourage listeners to understand it as, you know, as an experience of a set of experiences of not being able to afford adequate energy services. So that means we are also talking heating your home, but also cooking, lighting, and having enough of that energy to secure that you are in good health and that you live a dignified life.
So this for 2024, obviously, close to one in three households face some affordability challenges. I mean, prices have increased quite significantly since then. It would be fair to presume that the situation has worsened somewhat?
Yes. Well, the latest data now we have for 2025, and it has shown improvements since 2023, 2024, and now 2025, according to one of the measures that we use to analyze energy poverty. But yes, definitely with fuel prices as high as they are, they will be, you know, eventually reflected on the electricity costs of households, you know, besides them also having to manage other expenses like the fuel in their vehicles or for transportation, you know, because everything goes to the same, you know, to your disposable income, to what households used to afford everything.
So there are obviously some very prosperous parts of this country, and then we have where I'm speaking to you from, for an example, Donegal, where we have the second lowest annual disposable income. So obviously, if this is a medium or average or however you describe it as a number cruncher, the reality is the situation may be much worse. And I know you work on figures and perhaps don't want to speculate, but just in terms of how the figures are figured out, we probably have a greater number than 30% in an area such as Donegal.
Well, I think, like, if you want to talk numbers and in terms of the distributions, you might be, yes, on the higher end of that distribution, so around 30% or something like that. But, you know, what's important is that, yes, the report does identify that rural households and households with low income, as well as the elderly or single parents, are especially vulnerable to energy poverty. But, you know, like this report is financed, has been financed by the government. So they're looking into that. They want to understand this. And what we are suggesting is that, one, there's this monitoring system that's put in place to really track what is happening with energy poverty. There's new research coming from the ESRI that will speak to you about the different differences in regions across Ireland. Mm. But this is ongoing work.
And in terms of how we address this, do you look at that, Andres? Because, I mean, we've had universal credits in the past. It would not be hard, I don't think, to target those who perhaps need, you know, targeted supports in that regard. You know, the government is probably using this information to decide what it's going to do into the future in terms of supporting families. Do you have a view, Andres, on what the most effective way of helping those that need the help most is?
Well, what our research finds is, or highlights, is that you have a difficult choice to make. On the one hand, supports like what the government has defaulted on in the past reach everyone, right? So it's given to everyone, to people who need it, and but also to people who don't. So targeting, basically what it does is taking some of that excess from the people who don't need it, and we could be providing more adequate support to those who need it, because maybe, you know, like some of the people in the most extreme situations of energy poverty need more than the 450 or 250 euros that they received in the past years.
Okay, interesting. Thank you, Andres. That's Andres Esteves, who's co-author, who's co-author of Energy Poverty and Affordability in Ireland, talking of that government-commissioned research, which I wasn't aware of. Not that that matters, but it's interesting to see how they might use that then going forward. Catholic education on that issue. They all want Catholic education and the big days of communion and confirmation, but there's very little actual practice on a weekly basis. Again, though, it's quite interesting along the lines of that comment. The gentleman we spoke to themselves says the church doesn't hold people to that standard, and yet people like this commentator do. In England, parents have realised Catholic education is one of the best in the world, and there are massive waiting lists to get into them. And as, again, we heard from our guest, it's not just England, it's elsewhere. Another, from what I understand, not everyone was aware of the survey, and I don't understand how the survey was not given to parents through the school. I know there was many groups on different sides of this argument. We had them on this show, not presuming for a second everyone hears it, but you know, there was a lot of information out there. It would have been hard to miss between newspapers, the internet, and the likes of ourselves. It would have been hard to miss that it was happening, but yeah, was it not distributed through the schools? A caller says it's not the Catholic schools to offer their schools over to another religion or none to govern. It's simple. If they want it, build them. But there is a recognition that if there are four Catholic schools in a small area, and there is enough people who would be able to populate three of those Catholic schools, and then, you know, others to populate the one multi-denominational one, the church seems open to having a look at that. Well said, Greg. No one's going into the Jewish schools saying they need to be multi-denominational. Yeah, and I wasn't having a dig in relation to that. It's just, sometimes we need to have a little bit of pride as well, I think, in not just in this area, but in lots of different areas. Another caller says Catholic education is not disappearing, but is becoming smaller and becoming more dependent on government school choice policy than ever before. Another, have you seen the guy in New York who returned to his Catholic faith and has created a huge gathering on a Sunday for Mass again? You'll always get little pockets like that, of course. Another, it's considered by the Catholic Church to be a mortal sin if a Catholic does not attend Holy Mass on Sunday. I'll have to check that out, is it? Because if it is, I'm going down. Could you please play a request wishing a very happy birthday to our beautiful daughter Emily, who is 6 today. Wish her a very happy birthday from Mum and Dad, big brother George, and her dog Belle. Thanks. Now, Daniel and Magella O'Donnell boiled the kettle of peel. They're holding a coffee morning in aid of Relay for Life Donegal at Carpet Interiors, Unit 2, Pine Hill Industrial Estate, to Mountain Top, Letterkenny, Thursday the 30th of April. from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. There's a free home energy event taking place, which promises simple advice and real savings for your home and business. And it's not a sales pitch, it's just answers to your questions, I'm told. And it is taking place on Thursday, the 30th of April. And it's between 6:30 p.m. and 8:30 p.m. Drop in any time at the Moff GEA Football Grounds. I want to mention, too, that there is a sunrise walk on Saturday, the 9th of May. It's at 4:15 a.m. What does that say? Can't zoom in. Sunrise Brews at Binion after walk. All right, so you can have a cup of tea afterwards. So you're invited to meet at the Binion Beach car park for 4 a.m. and all donations to the Loch Swilly RNLI. So 100% of money raised goes directly to the local RNLI. We all know fantastic organisation. So that's at Binion Beach on Saturday the 9th. Get there for 4 a.m., have your walk, enjoy the sunrise, and then have a cup of tea or coffee afterwards. Right, we're joined by Aaron Daly from Donegal, who is the father of Sophia, who has cerebral palsy. I won't even try to do that as a service. Aaron, you're going to help me in here. Talk to me about Sophia and the conditions that she has.
Good morning, Greg. Sophia was born with cerebral palsy and arthrogryposis, which meant that basically from birth she would need hospital care and attention, and she would need treatments as she grew up to help her get on with just activities of daily living, you know. I suppose it was a big unknown at the start how much care she would need, or, you know, how life would pan out for her. Mm. But we moved to Dublin to be closer to services, because we know that there's a lack of services in the northwest. My wife Jones from Manor Hamilton and Leitrim there, and it was just for us to give Sophia the best chances in life. We decided to move to Dublin and be near Crumlin Hospital. As she was growing up, we encountered many difficulties over the years. You know, she developed scoliosis. We quickly learned that we would have to start fighting for services, whether that be school services or new wheelchairs or equipment. So you find yourself, not only are you a carer and you become carers and the whole family become carers, but you also become by default advocates. And we were very strong advocates over the years and continue to be, so just that we can maybe stop other families going through the same thing that we went through, you know.
Obviously, I think you were amongst a group of quite a large number of people, Aaron, that had their reservations about the location of the new children's hospital. And we've heard the counter arguments about it being close to other hospitals and what have you. But I don't think anyone, even those that maybe thought this was the right project in the wrong place, would have anticipated this. I think the only word for it is a disaster of a process of trying to get it built and finished.
Yeah, look, right at the start when they announced St. James's, a few of us started like opposition and petitions against it. Then I became part of a bigger group, Connolly for Kids. And we had basic things that were highlighted in red flags at that stage. The site at St. James's was completely inaccessible. And even when, if the hospital opened tomorrow, there's no dedicated bus lane or ambulance corridor, and that area is heavily congested. So number one, that was a red flag. And this is the National Children's Hospital. So anybody in Donegal knows that when you're traveling to Dublin, like outside the M50 can be upgraded, and the government have 50 hectares of land at Connolly. And that would have been like a much preferable site. The counter arguments kind of brought in St. James's Hospital as an adult speciality hospital. But the reality is, we would benefit far more from an adjoining maternity hospital. And we know the maternity hospital sagas that are going on. If you picture, and we know parents who campaigned with us, whose children were born very ill and taken away in an ambulance and off to a children's hospital, and then they had to follow. You know, there's better outcomes if there's an adjoining maternity hospital. Now, the government say they're going to build one there, but I guess they want to get the first one done first. We also said it would cost a lot more to build, and there would be delays in building. But not even us. Like, we handed the Department of Taoiseach back in the time 60,000 signatures just to say, can we just stop and look at it, have a look at it, and change the direction here. But none of that was taken on board.
And yet,
St. James' site is really congested.
Yeah, and here we are, Aaron, and unfortunately that genie can't be put back in the bottle. But I understand, and the government is quite right in criticising BAM for the delays in delivering this hospital. But those criticisms ring a little bit hollow if the actual infrastructure to improve access to it hasn't been done. That's their responsibility in conjunction with the local authority in TAI.
But that's what I'm hearing. BAM should be doing this, and the construction company should be doing this. Like this, the government signed a contract at 650 million. It was supposed to be 450. It went up to 657 very quickly. The cost jumped to 1.7 million within 2 years. There was a raucous hearings. There was warnings. They were told the contract was wrong. Yet, they kept going with it and they didn't change anything to do with it. Now, if you're building an extension at your house or building a house, you get your contract, you sign up, you get the design, and, you know, never in the private world would this be tolerated.
Can I add another thing on top of that?
You probably
wouldn't continue to use that contractor for multiple other developments on your property either if they still hadn't finished your extension.
That contractor previously had ended up in court with the Irish government, and they've brought them in for another one. But Leo Varadkar said, and this is his quote, short of an asteroid hitting the planet, the 650 million hospital will be open by 2020. Now, we know how much of a disaster it is, but why is there no accountability for the decision makers and government? Why hasn't anybody stood up and said, look, we have got this wrong,
because
this is what's going to happen?
Because we can't hear, Aaron, can't hear get accountability for someone who double-counted beds at the Buncrana Community Hospital and inadvertently misled the public. So if you can't get accountability or an answer in relation to that, who's going to put their hand up and take responsibility for this? Can I ask one question, though, of you, Aaron?
Well, can I give you...
Yes, please, go ahead. Go on.
Yes. I'll just give you these figures. During the build start phase of the hospital, there was 42,000 children waiting nationally, with nearly 9,000 waiting over 18 months. This is the waiting list for children, right?
Mm.
If we bring it to now, mid-construction, there's over 106,000 children waiting for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
Some are waiting up to 5 years. Some, like Harvey, will never get treatment, and families are going through that. So if this was the government's answer to all the waiting lists and the children getting treatment and timely treatment, like, the waiting lists have tripled over the size of this. And it has been flagged now, because of the population increase, the hospital's now actually technically too small for our population. So they should be building an extension at this stage. It's just an asset. Yet again, we see a flagship project, and it's absolutely hitting all the red flags around. And it's not the politicians that are suffering. It's the thousands of families around the country. We're heading towards 1 million people on waiting lists, and they're waiting on timely care. And like Sophia, if you don't get timely care, complications arrive. Then when you get for treatment, the treatment is longer, more complicated, more risky, and takes more resources and recovery.
Yeah,
like, we are imploding. And if they can't have responsibility for themselves, then we actually have to get to a point where when it comes around the elections, we don't reward them for their failures. And that's...
But the thing is, accountability... I sat 10 years... For actions in office, outside of maybe attending a golf event that you shouldn't have attended or whatever, there's very little accountability in this country, and there's no real drive to change that. I mean, you could go through the printer, you can go through the bike shed, you can go through the... There's a whole list of controversies. You can come up here back to the Northwest, the community hospital, a new special school opening that can't meet the current capacity, you know, not really knowing how many beds is needed in a community hospital for a peninsula the size of a county. But there's no one takes the hit for it. You know, I'm not looking for a public hanging, don't get me wrong, but some sense that if there is a mistake made or if there is an oversight or if there's foot dragging, that you have to have responsibility or the system never improves.
And we saw recently how people power, when people get out and actually protest, whether you agree with it or not, how change can happen. And there is growing talk among the disability community and the care community and the people affected negatively by all this. You know, if we were to walk up with a 500 wheelchairs and start blocking streets in Dublin or blocking, you know, that's an extreme example. But that's what people are talking about at the minute. Is that what we have to do now to start to get care for our children? Should we be doing that and protesting? And by the way, so many families around the country are affected by this, so it shouldn't just be the families affected. Everybody should row in and demand that we actually get... Like,
do you know the funny thing, Aaron?
It is raining for a lot of people.
It is. And I understand we can't have the best of care in every part of the country. I understand that. But this, at the start of this conversation, and it was almost a throwaway, you and your family, through the love of Sophia and wanting the best for her, moved up sticks and moved closer to hospitals. I mean, that in and of itself is just remarkable that we have to do that. But we do. Aaron, listen, thank you very much for your time and your input and your knowledge. I do appreciate it. Right. Now, on the president, Michael D. Higgins, a former president, this caller says he returned more than €2.5 million to the Exchequer over the course of his 14 years in the role. Great to see a president more conscious of the spending in this country. Why are people dumping their grass cuttings along the main road? Have they not got a compost heap? Asked a listener. I wonder, maybe they're being dumped there for collection. It seems unusual. A lot of people at the protests were driving Northern Reg lorries and big tractors. Were they subsidised for fuels? Well, the state's subsidy would be very specific to vehicles operating here, I'm sure. On the issue of Catholic schools, remember the referendum where we were forced to repeat the voting until the government got the result they wanted? Now there seems to be a focus on the 40% rather than accepting the result of the 60% or the 70% in this county. But that doesn't mean that you can't meet the needs of that 40% too. It just gives you a better understanding of what demand might be out there. And as we heard earlier on, get into the schools. The schools will get specific data for the schools and have the conversation and tease it out and make sure that it's done that way. I personally think that education for Catholics stops after the confirmation. Maybe if the wonderful true value of the Mass was explained to more in more detail to children, there'd be a greater understanding and attendance. Right, so we heard earlier on of a sharp increase in cocaine use. The majority of people seeking, at least in one centre, seeking support for addiction is alcohol still number one, but cocaine a very close second. We'll get a bit of an insight into what the situation is closer to home here with Stephen McLaughlin, who's Director of Clinical Services at White Oaks Rehabilitation Centre in Mough. Stephen, thank you so very much for your time this morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Captain Greg?
I think, you know, I mean, we get report after report after report. I think we do know the trends anyway, because we've discussed it on this programme and on other platforms before. And it's being picked up too, isn't it, at White Oaks, that there we are seeing changes in, you know, dependency and addiction.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, very much so, you know, in terms of the report about the increase in the use cocaine, that would certainly be something that would be reflected in the numbers coming through our own service here at White Oaks. In the last 8 to 10 years, there has been an increase, particularly in the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years. It's got to the point where, as I would describe it, anyone usually under the age of about 40, 45 is most likely to present here with cocaine addiction as well as perhaps alcohol. You know, that's just the reality that we find ourselves dealing with more and more. And obviously, it seems to indicate that the availability of cocaine and the acceptability of it socially, all of that has changed quite significantly. And one of the things I have been interested in trying to understand is the social impact of this change. I think that the reach of cocaine addiction today into every community, no matter how small, how rural, you know, when you take an area like Donegal, it's mainly a rural community. And in the past, cocaine was seen as something that was most likely found in urban areas among a certain kind of group of people, maybe professional types. All of that has changed, and it's now become much more, if you like, mainstream. And the effects of it then are quite far-reaching because what we would notice is that people, once they begin to use cocaine, there's an acceleration of the addiction in a way that perhaps is different from alcohol. A person gets into difficulty with alcohol in their life after maybe a few years, whereas when someone starts using cocaine, a young person, they seem to get into difficulty with the cocaine very quickly. And there's a deterioration in their whole quality of life, in their relationships, in their ability to maintain work, and just right across the whole spectrum of life, it seems to be impacted quite significantly whenever they use cocaine. So that's a very worrying feature. And then, of course, the implications as regards mental health. You know, if you're speaking to people working in the hospital setting, you would find that quite a lot of the presentations there of young people would be those who perhaps are suffering various forms of psychosis when they've been using cocaine on a regular basis. So there is a significant shift. And, you know, in Ireland, it's particularly noticeable. And, you know, the things that I read would indicate that it has become socially more acceptable. And perhaps Ireland is a very easy market for people who are looking to make a lot of money.
But just in relation to that, Stephen, and this is probably my naivety, or maybe there isn't even an answer, but in terms of alcohol and alcohol misuse, every shop now, it seems, has an off-licence. We have an awful lot of pubs. You know, you can phone a taxi and get booze delivered to your house. You know, the access to alcohol is dead simple. I wouldn't even know where to start how to acquire cocaine. But obviously, there's an awful lot of information out there as to how you get your hands on it. I presume maybe it's through Snapchat or Facebook. I just simply don't know. But there's obviously a great deal of knowledge if we are seeing so many people presenting with an addiction, because obviously those are only the ones that are presenting with an addiction and not the true number. And it's I just don't know how we can't break this network or find out what's going on or why it's so accessible.
Well, I think that the other factor in this is the, you know, when you speak about the availability, I think it's social media, in the sense that a lot of young people that we would work with here would speak about being able just to go on some of the platforms, and they can get it very easily. I mean, the kind of pithy way that some people have described it to me is that it's easier to get a bag of cocaine than it is to get a pizza on a Saturday night, and you know, in any of the towns. So, I suppose in the youth culture, their way of communicating and all of that seems to make it much easier to get access. And what you tend to find is that a lot of those who are using cocaine, the people that are providing it, the dealers, tend to be people that they know, friends or friends of friends, people that they maybe are mixing with socially. Obviously, it comes down the line from a different source. You might call the bigger players, the people who are making lots and lots of money. But when people are using it locally, it's usually sourced from someone that they know. And quite often, people who are dependent themselves would become dealers in order to feed their own habit.
And it can be, it can, there. I know there are a lot of, say, for instance, criminal damage instances that are linked to this. So it's not just there's a supplier, buy cocaine, take cocaine. Like you, if you don't come up with the money or if you're accused of shortchanging them or anything like that, there is a lot of activity out there in terms of, you know, smashing up cars, smashing up houses. It's a dark and murky space. It can get that way very, very quickly. And of course, that kind of violence or persuasion can then be used to drag people into transporting drugs or becoming a dealer themselves. You know, it's a very murky space. I think it's presented quite sexy on telly, cocaine particularly. You know, we if you look at how alcohol is presented on TV, it's generally negative. Smoking, very rarely you see it now, but generally negative. Drugs, it's kind of cool and sexy and chic and city and glamorous. And of course, we know all. So there's an awful lot there pushing people into that direction. But when they get there, I don't think they realize how dark and murky and violent and coercive that world actually is.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's certainly not a victimless kind of activity. And, you know, it certainly is the case that the process of cocaine arriving into somebody's hand, it has gone through all sorts of different processes, if you want to say. And it is, as you say, a very murky world, and where there are very clear victims. People obviously aren't thinking about that at that particular moment in time, but I do think that as a society, and especially in our communities, there is a need to kind of waken up to the reality of what it's doing in people's lives. You know, that it's having a serious impact on young people. I, for example, am curious about, you know, the sporting organizations. I know what awareness that they would have of young people using cocaine, because again, anecdotally, I would hear stories of young people maybe not using alcohol because it might affect their athletic or physical performance, but you know, using cocaine because they think that perhaps it won't have the same effect on them. And a lot of this stuff and sometimes is happening in clear sight. You know, it's in plain sight. It's happening in the sense that people know what's going on. But I don't think there's a real recognition of the social impact that it's having, as you mentioned, particularly on families and the pressure that it's bringing to bear. What we would hear from people who come through our service here at White Oaks is that quite often relationships, especially when it's family or where there are children involved, all of those things are really significantly being affected by someone developing a dependency on cocaine. So, you know, it's something which certainly has changed, and it's changing the whole texture of community life. And it's something I think we're kind of sleepwalking into
And we
without
have to be,
recognizing.
you know, it's very important what you're saying about the youth there, but there's a few things that we also have to maybe connect or explore connections. You know, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, and then we got statistics from the newspaper today, the Donegal News, I believe, 1,400 calls in a single year to Gardaí about domestic violence instances. I'm not saying they're linked to that, but you talked about the social consequences of it. It's all in that same space, and you know, if we tackle or deal, if we tackle or deal with one area, could it have a positive impact in reducing, you know, victims in an, in another area? And I think we need to dig into that much greater. And I think the point you make about because you choose your words far better than I, but I have read up, and there are people who want to avoid hangovers or just want a high that would opt for cocaine rather than booze, not conscious of the damage it would be doing to their to their internal organs, what have you. Definitely a factor and something that maybe the sports organisations could pick up on. Thank you so much for your time, Stephen.
Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Goodbye. 086 60 25000. That is your WhatsApp, and well, it's our WhatsApp and text number, and it's the numbers that you can use to get in touch with us if you want to discuss anything you heard there. I think for many of us, our heads are in the ground. I think I'm one of those that, you know, maybe I don't really know the full extent, obviously, other than what we discuss on this program, of what is going on out there between people going into, I don't know, casinos, pubs, getting cocaine, whatever it might be, and then potentially that impact it might have on the care for children, domestic violence situations. It all has to have some sort of a link, does it not? Now, we had a quite an interesting and detailed interview yesterday on Buncrana Nursing Unit. If you missed that, by the way, John Joe McGowan from the HSC, effectively IHA, was on discussing mistakes that have been made and what the plans are for the future. Can you ask your guest from the HSC, said a listener, read Buncrana Nursing Unit, who made the mistake on the 41 beds? Couldn't find out the answer to that. Why was the homework not done when coming to a two-hour meeting? What allocation to beds have been made of all 36 now allocated? Long-term respite, palliative care. There's ample grounds for a new day service and chalet besides the old GP. Will you now develop plans, drawings for this service? Couldn't timeline it, but said that's probably down the line. Who is responsible for this mistake? Again, we couldn't get that answer. Where is Dermot Moynihan? Frank Morrison said twice at the meeting there was 41 beds allocated. But you see, what every time 41 was mentioned, that came off the back of bad information. That's the problem, isn't it? Greg, does your guest think we the listeners are stupid as regards to the Buncrana project? Please, once again, no accountability for all these errors. Another, it's ridiculous to propose 36 beds instead of 41. We need a three-story high unit with at least 100 beds. How is it a community hospital? It's more like a nursing home. We need these facilities and have been calling out them for years. And that's the point. That's the question I asked yesterday. You know, what is the data to suggest that 36 beds is the number? Well, it's not a renovation or a new building. It's a refurbishment. Okay, so you can see that I'm not saying there's anything mischievous in that language. So down the line, a development would add further beds, but this is not a development as such. This is a refurbishment. Can Greg ask for a breakdown between long-term and short-term respite beds, re the 36 beds? Caroline, can we chase that up about, because that's a question I didn't get to. It's just the 36 beds in Buncrana Nursing Unit. What's the makeup of them? I want to bring that to listeners because a few people have asked that. Will there be adequate staff available for the 36 beds as soon as it's ready? I put that question to John Joe McGowan. He said that that is the plan, but you just don't know. How will beds be allocated? Another, let me ask that question for you. When is the public meeting going to be held regarding the new community hospital in Buncrana? We need the public to be involved, not just politicians. And I agree with you, to be honest with you, fully. And John Joe McGowan says there is no plan for a public meeting, but he will bring that back to the HSE, and if they can get some movement on that, it will happen. Right, Keith Gamble, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How's things?
All's good. Now, exciting times this May public holiday weekend, because the Bear Run 74 supercar road trip is kicking off in Ballybuffet, and I've seen this a couple of times, some beautiful, beautiful cars, and it's always for a good cause, Keith. So what can people look forward to?
So this weekend, Greg, this is going to be our fifth trip this year, and we're starting off in Moneymore on Friday in Cookstown, and we're making our way to Applegreen and Lifford for 5 p.m. on Friday evening. So we have 74 supercars on it, everything from Lamborghinis, Ferraris, McLarens and Porsches. They're coming from Scotland, England, and all over Ireland and Northern Ireland for the weekend.
Right, so run down then the opportunities for people in Donegal, because I have Ballet Buffet here on Saturday the 2nd of May, so I want to make sure I don't give out bad information. So
no.
where will the cars be? I mean, obviously it's going to be a spectacle to see them in convoy, but where can the public sort of meet up with you guys?
Yeah, so anybody in the public want to come and see us on Friday, we'll be in Applegreen in Lufford at 5 p.m. for a fuel stop, so we should be there up to maybe 30 minutes. Saturday morning is the official start line in Ballet Buffet at 9 a.m. and we will be there to 10:30, and then we are making our way to Donegal Town to meet Anna, the mayor. We're going to do a lap of Donegal Town, and then we are making our way then towards Ballinalak. So we're way down the country towards Kilkenny on Saturday evening. So Saturday morning, definitely Ballet Buffet is one you don't want to miss, Greg.
All right, brilliant stuff from 9 a.m. till 10:30. And you can get more information on the internet, thebearrun74.com or Instagram and Facebook. Just search thebearrun74. And Bumblance Children's Ambulance Service, which has its origins here in Donegal, and that's a fascinating story in and of itself. That's the charity that's benefiting this time.
Yeah, we done Bumblance last year, and we raised over 52,000 for them in 3 days. So look, every year I set out to beat it, but if the people get out and support us and get behind us, I can't see why not. And we have a GoFundMe page there as well set up, so every little bit helps. And as I say, this weekend is all about raising money for charity, but it's about the children and stuff getting pictures in these cars. It's memories that last forever.
Yeah, for sure. Right, so Bumblance was the last year's beneficiary, 52 grand. That's amazing. That's a fantastic figure. Right, okay, so people check out socials, The Bear Run 74, Facebook, The Bear Run 74, Ballet Buffet, Main Street, Saturday morning at 9 a.m. to 10:30. If you're in the south of the county, get to Donegal Town, because there'll be a procession down there as well, and great viewing points and some beautiful, beautiful cars. And then Lifford Friday evening for a refuel. What time did you say again?
Yeah, we'll be there at 5 p.m. on Friday.
Okay.
Like the most expensive car we have coming this year is a Lamborghini Revolto. It's the only one probably in Ireland, maybe two, 600,000 that was. So
well, I want that back.
Going to see you again, Greg, if that makes sense.
Well, I want that back without any scratches on it, because I was good enough to lend it to you, you know?
No problem. Good, you man. Look after the fuel bill as well. Another one, we have a special guest coming this weekend as well, Nadia from Ashford Motors.
Okay.
So if anybody's into their cars, we'll know Nadia. Nadia's coming the whole weekend with us.
That's great. She's a great character on social media and loves her cars as well. Fantastic. So you'll get a good reach through your own. Yeah, exactly. But also, you know, very popular. Lovely. Okay, Keith, look after yourselves. Sounds fantastic. So Lifford at 5 Friday, Ballet Buffet, 9 a.m. Then from 10:30 a.m. they'll make their way down. Bring your kids along, get some pictures with the cars, and not just the kids. We love our vehicles here in the Northwest, don't we? Thanks, Keith. Well done. 52 grand they raised last year for Bumbulance Children's Ambulance. Remarkable stuff.
Business Matters is proudly sponsored by Prince Supplies Frosses. With 21 years in business, Prince Supplies provides managed print solutions with local support and remote ink monitoring, saving your business time and money. Prince Supplies, your local printer and photocopier company.
Now, Highland Radio's Business Matters podcast will be available for you later today, or potentially tomorrow morning, but certainly will be available for you tomorrow. Its presenter is Chris Ashmore. He's in studio with me. Chris, how are you?
Very good, Greg.
Radio, any news?
Yes, a couple of things coming up of note. Inishowen Innovation is hosting what's called a European Co-working Day at its premises in Buncranna next Wednesday. So you can go along. You'll have a free hot desk for the day. There's also lunch. So it's a chance to maybe just see what these hot desks are all about. You can get a little bit of information as well for that. And there's ones located in many centres all over the county, and it's great for people.
They're popular, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And it can be a lot cheaper than building an office or renting an office, and you're in with other people as well, so there's a little bit of a social networking too.
Right, the Letterkenny Chamber's President's Lunch is at the Radisson Blue Hotel on Friday, June 12th, and the keynote speaker has been confirmed.
Yes, it'll be Jack Chambers, who is the Minister for Public Expenditure, Infrastructure, Public Service Reform and Digitalisation. So that has just been confirmed, so that'll be a big day for all involved there in the Chamber.
Has our personal invites, Caroline, come for that yet? No, I haven't just landed yet. yeah. ATU are hosting an open evening this day week. I always struggle when we cross the turn of the month, but this day week, what's happening?
Yes, it's on Thursday the 7th of May, 4 o'clock in the afternoon to 6:30, and it's a chance for students and indeed their families to explore university life and get a little bit of guidance ahead of, this is the significant thing, the CAO change of mind deadline, which is just looming. So look, if you want to get an inside view of the ATU, and there'll be people there on hand to direct you. It's a big decision, of course, Greg, making there's so much on offer. Possibly that is part of the problem. There's too much.
That's why you go to these things. Right, burger and kebab of the year. I don't know if this is sort of like doner kebabs and what have you, but I struggle to get a nice doner kebab. I find the kebabs now have just the meat is defrosted. It's always red onion, and I want white onion, garlic, mayo, sweet chili in a kebab. You know, it's disgusting. Like, it's very, I find it struggling to get a good kebab. This could just be bits of meat on a metal sheet. So, I don't know. But anyway, there's a competition upcoming.
Well, the Association Craft Butchers of Ireland have just actually held their inaugural Burger and Kebab of the Year competition. And Joe McGee's Butchers in Letterkenny won the Best in Ulster Award for their caramelised red onion beef burger.
That would bring a nice bit of sweetness. I don't mind my red onion in that situation. Okay. Congratulations to
Joe McGee.
Right, what's coming up then? You have two guests, two items on the show.
Yes, Business Matters this week. Two items focusing on, first of all, Vertiv, which has factories in Burntfoot, Letterkenny and Derry. It's undertaking a major recruitment drive at the moment. Hundreds of positions on offer. It's a global leader. Making critical infrastructure and supports. A lot of it's used in data centres, and this is, helps with the whole cooling side of things and thermal wall units. So they're a huge player. Indeed, they've 34,000 employees around the world and $10 billion revenue. So it's a big, big operation. They're hosting an open day at Ungreenan Hotel in Burt next Wednesday from 9 to 5. And I've been speaking with Fiona Fisher, who's Senior HR Manager based in the Burntfoot premises.
At the moment, we are looking for several hundred new roles to be filled across our three Northwest facilities. So we're mainly looking for panel wires, electricians and general operators across all three of our locations. So we have, you know, great opportunities now available for this region, and this is a region that we're really, really proud to be supporting in terms of the jobs and investment that we're putting in. So, really, really exciting time.
Yeah, some good opportunities. Listen to that full interview in the podcast and that open day on Greenan Hotel in Bird, Wednesday, May 6th, between 9 and 5. Right, who else is on the show?
I've been speaking with Balbuffet-based Aidan Thompson, who's just launching a new business venture at the moment called the Mind Maze. He's offering psychotherapy and coaching to businesses, individuals and organisations. So very much to do with mental health, pointing people in the right direction. He's a very interesting background himself. He'd been a winchman on the search and rescue helicopters off the Northwest. He suffered a very bad injury himself. So this is a new departure for him. He's done a lot of studying and enrolled in numerous courses. And we have a clip here from him as well about what he's doing.
Usually what happens is the presenting issue, the issue that they're coming to us with, isn't necessarily the main issue in their life that they need to work through or work with. So when I meet a client for the first time, the first session would be, you know, getting a good kind of detailed history and figuring out what it is that these people want to work on. And sometimes they don't even realize that it's, you know, something from their past that might need psychological support, or something as simple as, you know, just making a decision and not being procrastinating or not being stuck in, you know, frozen, unable to make a choice or a lifestyle choice for themselves. So it is open for anyone, really, and it's just guidance. It's helping people. As psychotherapists, we can't give advice. It would be one of the big no's in psychotherapy. You can't advise a client what to do, but this is kind of walking beside them and you know, maybe opening up a few doors and just pointing them in the right direction.
All right, so as I mentioned, that podcast will be available for you from tomorrow morning, and it's going to be on air, of course, after 6 on Sunday, Chris.
That's right, Greg, after the 6 o'clock news on Sunday.
And if anyone wants to contact you, who should they contact, or how do they contact you, but how do they?
Easiest way is the email address, which is businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
I watched Arsenal last night. How do you put yourself through that on a weekly?
Well, that was better than the Newcastle game last weekend.
Did you watch the game the night before, though?
Well, I didn't, because it wasn't on terrestrial TV, which I was shocked. There's been matches on all year, and suddenly there was no Paris Saint-Germain and Bayern Munich. I saw the highlights last night. Yeah, what a game. What a game.
Squeaky bum time now for Arsenal, though.
It sure is, yeah.
You need some of that stuff that you, when you're doing a big run, slap on yourself. Ass Magic. Do you ever use Ass Magic?
No.
It's supposed to be the best.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yep, I'll take your word.
Right, thank you very much, Chris. We'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Have a fantastic Thursday, everyone. We've a busy show for you tomorrow, and the podcast released at 11 a.m. as well. I'll tell you about that when we speak again tomorrow morning at 9.